economists contended, understood incentives. Lauded as a sophisticated and sensible reformer, Gorbachev differed little from any of his three dead predecessors, except that they were dead communists and he was still breathing. He did admit that the Soviet Union was in trouble. A dedicated Marxist-Leninist, married to a teacher of Marxism-Leninism, Gorbachev had no intention of abandoning the dream of victory over the West. As Arkady Sevchenko, a Soviet diplomat, pointed out, men do not reach the pinnacle of communist power without an abiding commitment to the rightness of the Soviet system. As late as 1987, Gorbachev still thought the works of Lenin and his ideals of socialism, an inexhaustible source of creative thought, theoretical wealth, and moral sagacity. Reagan realized instantly that Gorbachev was a true believer, but one looking for a way to save communism, not change it as so many Westerners thought. In fact, the Gipper understood Lenin far better than Gorbachev did, reading his works each time in a new way. Indeed, Gorbachev saw the Stalin era and the Brezhnev period as simply a perversion of communist ideology, not its failure. In speeches before foreign audiences, he routinely portrayed the Soviet economy as fundamentally sound and merely fatigued. But his practical nature told him that the USSR was taking a beating in Afghanistan and was hopelessly outclassed by the US economy, and that Reagan's Star Wars proposal had theoretically eliminated the only significant advantage the USSR still held over America, its ICBMs. Gorbachev also found himself bound by Andropov's policy of installing mobile, short-range SS-20 nuclear missiles west of the Ural Mountains. Although a smaller and potentially less destructive class of missiles, the SS-20s were in fact extremely destabilizing weapons. Their mobility made them impossible to verify in treaty negotiations. How many were there? Where were they? Also, unlike every previous class of nuclear weapon employed by the Soviet Union, these missiles were not aimed at the United States, but at European capitals, Bonn, Brussels, Paris, London. Their purpose was crystal clear. They existed to frighten Europeans into breaching the NATO pact, delinking Europe from the U.S. nuclear umbrella. Once that had been accomplished, the Soviets could again regain the offensive through intimidation and, if necessary, well-placed force. Jimmy Carter had committed, in principle, to offsetting these weapons with Pershing and ground-based cruise missiles. Whether he ever would have deployed them was a question left unanswered by his defeat at the polls. But Reagan certainly had no hesitation in meeting the Soviet response. Working closely with Margaret Thatcher, Reagan persuaded NATO heads to accept the U.S. missiles on European soil. On November 14, 1983, after the Kremlin refused to withdraw its SS-20s, American cruise missiles and Pershings arrived in England and West Germany. When Gorbachev ascended to power, he intuitively concluded that the last hope of Soviet communism lay in the Euro missiles, and Soviet propagandists mounted a massive campaign to intimidate the Europeans into demanding the removal of the NATO weapons. Soviet spy Vasily Mitrokhin reported that the KGB was confident it possessed a nerve hold on Western public opinion when it came to European attitudes toward the United States and NATO. Still attempting to shape American public opinion, the Soviets supported and funded the nuclear freeze movement, which sought to freeze all new construction or deployment of nuclear weapons, leaving the Soviets with a huge strategic advantage. This included a status quo ante that would return Europe to its condition before the missiles were installed. Virtually the entire European left mobilized, using massive parades and demonstrations to intimidate the NATO governments. By the time Gorbachev had become General Secretary and inherited both Afghanistan and the Euro-missile crisis, he knew that he could not defeat the West. Gorbachev never considered a non-communist Soviet Union. As dissident Vladimir Bukovsky has said, he wants to save it together with his skin. But the General Secretary could read, and his senior economist at the Soviet Institute of U.S. and Canadian Studies and economic advisor Alexander Zaychenko warned him that if he tried to rebuild the Soviet economic glass house, it would shatter. Zaychenko pointed out to Gorbachev that the USSR was spending 20% of its GNP on weapons and research, whereas the United States was spending only 3-4%. Reagan appreciated Gorbachev's position, and he sensed in him a Russian leader who could actually be approached on a personal level. In 1985, at a Geneva meeting, Reagan managed to spirit Gorbachev away from his advisors, just the two men and their interpreters in a small cabin with a fire, and he spoke plainly face to face with the communist premier. By the time the hour-and-a-half meeting ended, Reagan had told Gorbachev bluntly, "You can't win an arms race." Then he offered the olive branch by inviting the Russian to visit the United States. Gorbachev accepted, then insisted Reagan come to Moscow. Meeting privately, the leaders of the two superpowers had accomplished far more than their advisors ever thought possible. It did not hurt Reagan's leverage that the Soviets found themselves bogged down in Afghanistan fighting against the Muslim rebels. In 1985, through the unflagging efforts of Texas Democrat Congressman Charlie Wilson, Reagan and his advisors were presented with a plan to arm the Afghans with a variety of weapons, ultimately including the powerful Stinger anti-aircraft missile. Wilson had to overcome the entrenched opposition of the CIA, which didn't think it possible to truly defeat the USSR, and ultimately devised an astounding scheme whereby the Israelis, via Egypt, would resell captured Soviet weapons to the Afghan Mujahideen through Pakistan using American money. When Reagan signed on to the sale of the Stingers, Charlie Wilson's war turned the corner toward victory. The missiles gave the Afghan warriors the capability of shooting down Soviet helicopters and even low-level fighters. Soviet losses mounted. Following the failure of the nuclear freeze propaganda campaign, Gorbachev gave up on the Euro missiles. He agreed to remove the SS-20s and opened up a dialogue with Reagan leading to the Intermediate Nuclear Forces, INF, Treaty, 1987. The INF Treaty was the first of its kind. Both sides agreed to withdraw their weapons and to destroy the SS-20s and the Pershings. From there, it appeared that Reagan's START Treaty would have clear sailing. In fact, however, it would not be needed. The Soviet Union would collapse before further treaties were required. When Reagan left office, he had greatly helped to cut down the rotting tree of Soviet communism. All that was needed for it to topple was a push from his successor. Morning in America. Not since 1972 had a starker contrast been put before the American electorate than in the election of 1984. Reagan's conservatism had ridden a wave of triumph since 1980. The tax cuts had produced a tremendous boom, the stock market had taken off, and the armed forces were resupplied and rearmed. More important, the nation had shaken off much of the self-doubt that had lingered since Vietnam and deepened under Carter. At the GOP convention renominating Reagan and Bush, the theme was, "It's morning in America." Reagan's natural optimism merged with the rapidly improving state of the Union to make him almost unbeatable. Democrats ran former Minnesota Senator and former Vice President Walter Mondale, who was a New Deal liberal to the left of Carter. Mondale chose a woman, Geraldine Ferraro, as his running mate, but the gimmick backfired because she brought to the campaign a tremendous amount of baggage in the form of charges of corruption in her husband's business and in her own campaign funding. Mondale, with little in the Reagan record to criticize, focused on the budget deficits and hoped to make an issue of the Gipper's age. But to address the deficits, Mondale promised to raise taxes, claiming he was only being honest, and most Americans were wary of returning to the bad old days of high taxes and high unemployment. When a moderator raised the question of Reagan's age in a debate, the president, off the cuff, responded, "I won't hold my opponent's youth and inexperience against him." Even Mondale laughed at that clever turnaround, which left the age issue in the dust. Mondale was crushed, losing every state but his home state of Minnesota, which he nearly lost as well, whereas Reagan had rolled up 59% of the popular vote, exceeding the victory margins of every other 20th century candidate except Roosevelt in 1936, LBJ in 1964, and Nixon in 1972. His optimism remained undaunted. "America is back," he said. "It's morning again." For those who wanted to see the United States as the fount of evil in the world, this was distressing indeed. Of course, to many others, especially those still trapped behind barbed wire and towers, his re-election was a sign of hope. 10 women in a Soviet forced labor camp managed to smuggle out an unusual message on a tiny piece of tissue paper, which Reagan could barely read with a magnifying glass. It said, "Mr. President, we women, political prisoners of the Soviet Union, congratulate you on your re-election. We look with hope to your country, which is on the road of freedom and respect for human rights." Despite his massive victory, Reagan soon faced a hostile Congress. In 1986, control of the Senate had shifted back to the Democrats. This was partly because of poor timing for Republicans, who had a number of key retirements. In part, it also reflected the unwillingness of many Republicans to sign on to Reagan's values, distancing themselves from supply-side economics and the tax cuts. In 1986, Congress, browbeaten by the media over the deficits, tinkered with the tax code again, eliminating many deductions. This had no effect on the deficits, but it slightly reduced the rate of growth of the economy. Even so, the expansion put in place by the tax cuts in 1981 had produced astonishing growth. Contrary to Reagan's critics, who claim the rich got rich and the poor got poorer, the blessings reached across the entire racial and class strata of American life. From 1982 to 1988, per capita income for whites rose 14%, and for blacks, 18%, compared to the Carter years of 2.4% for whites and 1% for blacks. Black unemployment was cut in half under Reagan, with 2.6 million African Americans joining the labor force, and the number of black families in the highest income bracket, $50,000 and over, rose by 86%. Reagan broke ground in other ways. In 1981, he had named the first woman to the Supreme Court when he appointed the moderate Arizonan Sandra Day O'Connor. And in 1986, when Chief Justice Warren Burger retired, Reagan moved conservative William Rehnquist into Burger's top slot. Rehnquist's seat was filled by another Reagan appointee, the brilliant Antonin Scalia, who would often be alone in his dissents until the appointment of his future soulmate, Clarence Thomas, by George H.W. Bush. But in 1987, Reagan's team failed him when, without properly solidifying support first, they sent to the Senate the name of another legal genius, Robert Bork, a federal appeals court judge and former U.S. Solicitor General. The Democrats lay in wait for Bork. Caught completely unaware, the president saw his nominee fail to win Senate approval. The new-look court, with Anthony Kennedy eventually winning Bork's slot, reversed some two decades of legal liberalism and criminals' rights decisions. States gradually won back some of their constitutionally granted powers, and the court curtailed the easy filing of discrimination suits that had clogged the judiciary with thousands of questionable claims. Reagan's goal of protecting the law-abiding citizens was realized, and the public approval numbers reflected its appreciation. A more serious reverse for the Reagan agenda came in November 1986, when news surfaced that administration officials had been involved in an effort to negotiate an arms-for-hostage deal with the Iranians. The United States had a long-standing set policy of refusing to negotiate with terrorists. But Reagan, who was personally troubled by the suffering of three Americans being held by radical Muslim groups in the Middle East, approved a deal that sent Iran weapons for use in Iran's war against Iraq. Even more troubling was the revelation that administration officials, apparently without Reagan's approval, had funneled money from that arms trade to the Contra rebels fighting in Nicaragua against the communist government there. Marine Colonel Oliver North, who became the focal point of the congressional inquiry that followed, was given immunity and proceeded to take all the blame himself, insulating Reagan. Democrats on the committee were outraged, having given North immunity to, in their view, implicate the president. All they had was a low-level colonel who had admitted to everything. Reagan's diaries are murky on the issue. One can read into his entries either a sense of relief that he had successfully plugged the hole and squashed the investigation, or a tone of exhaustion with the affair. In his televised address on the issue, he admitted that, "I let my personal concern for the hostages spill over into the geopolitical strategy of reaching out for Iran." He also insisted he did not know about any diversion of funds to the Contras. Critics of Reagan's administration cite the Iran-Contra affair as the central reason why the Gipper's last 4 years were not as productive as his first term. Much more damaging, however, was the shift in control of the Senate, combined with a host of cabinet-level resignations, defections, and even a death, Commerce Secretary Malcolm Baldrige in a rodeo accident. Many of Reagan's key insiders left to take advantage of their temporary fame and marketability, and former budget director David Stockman won short-lived celebrity status by bashing Reaganomics. Ultimately, however, Reagan realized that he had only enough time and energy left to see to fruition a couple of his most important agenda items, and at the top of the list was the demise of the Soviet Union. By 1986, rumblings within the Soviet Empire were a concern to the Kremlin. Dissidents had appeared with increasing frequency in Poland, Hungary, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and other corners of the USSR. Meanwhile, more than 100,000 Soviet troops continued to be pinned down in Afghanistan, and air losses there to the Stinger missiles supplied by the Reagan administration had accelerated. This prompted Gorbachev to issue an order that marked the first significant fissure in the Soviet Empire's wall. He ordered the withdrawal of 8,000 troops from Afghanistan. It was the first time during the Cold War that the Soviets had been stopped by a native population, albeit one heavily armed by America. It was, in the truest sense, reverse Vietnam. Reagan kept the pressure on, visiting the Berlin Wall in 1987, in one of history's most memorable moments, he demanded, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Ironically, a brief setback in market capitalism helped to tear down that wall. The Dow Jones dropped 508 points on October 19, 1987, in the worst decline since Black Tuesday in 1929. Much of the drop had to do with market perceptions that foreign loans, especially to communist countries, would not be repaid. Major banks turned off the credit spigots, and money flowing into Eastern Europe dried up. Anger over the false promises of communism boiled over in May 1988 when Hungary removed its single-party government and began to roll up its section of the Iron Curtain. Gorbachev, stung by Afghanistan, did not react. Poland followed. On Election Day in the United States, November 4, 1988, when Reagan's successor, George H.W. Bush, was winning his own landslide, a million people marched in East Berlin. A year later, the crowds took picks and axes to the Berlin Wall, destroying it and signaling the beginning of the end of the Cold War. "It's morning in America," Reagan's 1984 re-election campaign theme had proclaimed, and when the Gipper turned over the reins of power to Bush in January 1989, it was morning throughout much of the world. Ronald Reagan was in no small degree responsible for that dawn. Chapter 21. The Moral Crossroads, 1989-2000. Win one for the Gipper. When the Soviet Union abruptly fell apart in 1991, the nemesis that had opposed the United States in the Cold War for almost 50 years vanished overnight. Communism's demise stunned observers across the ideological spectrum, instantly changing the focus of American domestic politics. Republicans, who had championed a strong, well-funded military, suddenly found themselves without a major issue, and Democrats, who had complained that the military-industrial complex siphoned off resources from needed social programs, no longer had an excuse for failing to solve domestic problems. Moreover, Republicans found that some of their voting base, engineers and defense sector workers, had suffered an economic recession caused by the very success of Reagan's policies. Without the issue of Soviet communism to sharpen political choices, a move to the middle by both parties was natural, although not necessarily beneficial. Standing before the exuberant GOP convention in 1988, Reagan urged the delegates to support his successor, Vice President George H.W. Bush, the party's nominee. "Go out there and win one for the Gipper," Reagan enjoined the Republican faithful. And although he would not officially leave office until January 1989, Reagan cordially and politely stepped off the stage he had held for 8 years in order to turn the limelight on Bush. 5 years later, in a poignant letter to the nation, Reagan announced he had Alzheimer's disease. His quick wit faded, as did his health, until his death in 2004. Timeline: 1988, George H.W. Bush elected president. Hungary begins rolling up Iron Curtain. 1989, Berlin Wall falls. 1990, Bush violates Read My Lips pledge on taxes. Iraq invades Kuwait. Bush announces Operation Desert Shield. 1991, Operation Desert Storm evicts Iraq from Kuwait. Soviet Union collapses, replaced by Russia and independent states. 1992, Bill Clinton elected president, Rodney King beating. 1993, Travelgate, healthcare bill defeated, Branch Davidian compound at Waco destroyed by FBI and ATF agents, World Trade Center bombed by Al-Qaeda, U.S. Rangers killed in Somali raids. 1994, Republicans win House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. Special prosecutor appointed to investigate Clinton's Whitewater scandal. 1995, Oklahoma City bombing. House passes 9/10 of contract with America. 1996, Clinton re-elected. 1998, Lewinsky scandal breaks, Al-Qaeda bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa, Clinton impeached, air war against Serbia. 1999, Senate acquits Clinton. 2000, economy begins to slow. Y2K scare proves groundless. George Herbert Walker Bush came from a political family that many associated with privilege, even though his own money had come from hard work in the oil business. His father, Prescott Bush, had been a U.S. senator, and although the younger Bush had not held as many elective offices as a Walter Mondale or a Richard Nixon, he had been in and around Washington for long periods in his life. A fighter pilot who had seen combat in World War II, he returned to civilian life to make a fortune in petroleum, so he knew how the free market worked. He had served as ambassador, congressman, and, after the Nixon debacles, CIA director, restoring some of the confidence in that agency. Bush suffered from lingering distrust by conservatives because of his 1980 primary campaign against the clearly more conservative Reagan, during which the Texan had called Reagan's supply-side theories voodoo economics. He was the last of the Teddy Roosevelt progressive Republicans, although he lacked their righteous fervor. In contrast to the Democrats, however, Bush refused to abandon foreign affairs to serendipity. Unfortunately, he saw the economy in static terms, disdaining the benefits of tax cuts. Still, after 8 years of defending Reagan's successful policies and seeing their benefits, he had no choice in 1988 but to run on the Reagan record. This proved to be his great mistake. By lashing himself to a mast that he had no real faith in, his convention pledge, "Read my lips, no new taxes," would come back to haunt him. But that was 1990, and in 1988, Bush convinced enough Republicans that he was, indeed, a conservative. To further solidify their support, he chose young Indiana Senator Dan Quayle as his running mate. Quayle had a strong pro-military record in the Senate, even though during the campaign questions arose about his serving in the National Guard instead of in the regular army in Vietnam. And he had impeccable bona fides with the Reaganites. Unfortunately, he was painted by the media as a dim bulb, and he contributed to the image with uninspiring and mistake-prone speeches. However, his gaffes would pale in comparison to future Vice President Joe Biden, or even to President Barack Obama, who pronounced corpsman as corpsman, and who said the United States had 57 states. But Obama and Biden were liberals protected by the media, not attacked by them, as was Quayle. Ironically, the real story of the 1988 election was not about what had happened on the winning Republican side, but about the troubling changes that had taken place inside the losing camp and their long-range implications. Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis, the liberal governor of Massachusetts, had continued the left-wing tilt of the party. A new rival wing of the party, the Democratic Leadership Council, DLC, had originated from strategist Al Fromm's study of the 1984 election disaster, which argued that the Democrats had lost the middle-class vote and needed to move toward the center. Although such a strategy might seem like common sense, it reflected the problems of the Great Society Party that had become little more than a collection of special interests. Minorities, especially blacks, Hispanics, homosexuals, and feminists, labor unions, and environmentalists. Internal polling, however, showed that the Democratic Party was losing elections because it embraced a public philosophy that repelled the working class and middle class voters. Younger voices in the Democratic Party, such as Tennessee Senator Al Gore and Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, embraced the new high-tech economy. Party insiders after 1988 thought they were laying the groundwork for the presidency of one man, Al Gore. In the general election between Dukakis and Bush, however, Dukakis actually ran well ahead early in the campaign, stressing competence over ideology. Then Bush zeroed in on Dukakis's liberal policies in Massachusetts, including a prison furlough program. Using television ads in the primaries developed by Democrat Senator Gary Hart that featured Willie Horton, an African-American criminal who took advantage of his Massachusetts prison furlough to commit a rape, Bush's team created a campaign ad featuring Massachusetts as a revolving door for criminals. It proved deadly to the Dukakis campaign. The coup de grace was administered by the diminutive governor himself when, seeking to bolster his image as pro-military, he rode in a tank with only his small helmeted head sticking out of the massive armored vehicle. From then on, Dukakis could not escape editorial cartoons likening him to the cartoon soldier Beetle Bailey. Bush surged into the lead and on Election Day crushed the Massachusetts governor, grabbing 426 electoral votes, 40 states, and more than 53% of the vote. Communism collapses in Europe. George Bush had differences with his predecessor over economic issues, but when it came to the Cold War, he saw things much the same way as Reagan. Bush continued Reagan's hardline policies, and no sooner had he taken office than massive anti-communist labor strikes occurred in Poland under the Solidarity Movement led by Lech Wałęsa. At the same time, Hungary announced it would roll up its portion of the Iron Curtain. Having just pulled troops out of Afghanistan, Soviet strongman Mikhail Gorbachev had no appetite for sending tanks into Poland. The USSR looked on as the Poles demanded and won an agreement to hold free elections in 1990. Czechoslovakia and Romania soon followed. Then travel restrictions to West Germany from East Germany were lifted. Berliners responded in 1989 by smashing the most visible sign of oppression in the world, the Berlin Wall. At that point, the Soviet Union itself was starting to unravel. Patriots in Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, the Baltic republics brutally seized by Joseph Stalin in 1939, broke ties with the Soviet Union, again with no retribution. Gorbachev, believing his Western press clippings, assumed that Soviet citizens would view him the way American and European journalists saw him, as a man of peace and reason who had come to save the world. Instead, Soviet citizens, given a chance in December 1991 to vote for the first time since the communists took power in 1917, turned the communists out in consecutive elections once and for all. Subsequently, Boris Yeltsin, the chairman of the Russian parliament, emerged as leader of the anti-communist movement, and shortly thereafter, the once independent republics, like Ukraine, peeled themselves off. Yeltsin presided over the creation of 11 separate republics, joined under the new Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, which had none of the power, communist ideology, or malicious intent of its predecessor. The U.S. Congress authorized nearly $500 million to assist the republics in becoming stable democracies, but much of the cash disappeared into a cesspool of bribery and mafia-like operations. Lacking a tradition of either private property or rule of law, Russia would find that a peaceful transition to American-style capitalism would not come instantly. Ironically, communism almost fell too fast. American leaders for decades had supported pro-democracy forces in the Soviet Union, but at the moment of communism's collapse, Bush and his advisors appeared cautious, almost reticent to acknowledge that the Soviet dictatorship was gone. They hesitated to recognize many of the newly independent republics. The fact is that, like most Western anti-communists, Bush had not anticipated that the USSR would simply fall apart. He and Reagan had expected change, But the history of failed rebellions in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and other parts of the communist bloc had convinced them that change would be evolutionary and slow. For all of Reagan's insight, some of which had rubbed off on Bush, neither the president nor his team saw the moral abdication of the Soviet leadership coming. Soviet officials had ceased believing in the efficacy of Marxism-Leninism for years, a development characterized by Valery Bolden, Gorbachev's chief of staff, as the internal capitulation of Soviet leadership. The surrender by Soviet elites revealed what Polish dissident Adam Michnik called the intimate bond that exists between force and deception. Deception becomes a method of self-defense. Bolden described the resulting Western triumph as a total rout of the USSR and the moral devastation of a once powerful adversary. One author noted, "Just before the breakup of the USSR, the view of that country as a model of the most stable and durable regime in the world had gained wide acceptance among Western Sovietologists. There was not one American political scientist who predicted the collapse of the USSR. Richard Pipes, a Harvard Sovietologist, had done so, but he was nearly alone. Most Western intellectuals thought the Soviet government was indestructible, and liberals and conservatives alike had almost universally overrated the Soviet GNP and underrated its arms production. There is a certain truth to the notion that freedom itself constituted a potent weapon in the demise of Soviet communism. Freedom's steady buffeting of the communist system was most visible in Berlin when, during a concert in the mid-1980s by rock star Bruce Springsteen at the Berlin Wall, a scene took place that at one time would have seemed impossible to the party bosses. Springsteen naturally attracted thousands of free West Berliners, but hundreds of communist youths showed up on the other side of the wall to listen. When Springsteen sang "Born in the USA," there were thousands of ostensibly good socialists singing along, "Born in the USA, I was born in the USA." Soviet spy Vasily Mitrokhin's smuggled notes revealed that popular music and radio broadcasts from the West produced unhealthy signs of interest in pop stars and led to an almost surreal musical subversion in some cities. The KGB estimated that 80% of its youth listened to Western rock music broadcasts, which gave young people, in the eyes of the KGB, a distorted idea of Soviet reality and led to incidents of a treasonable nature. Spy memos warned that rock and roll has a negative influence on the interest of society, inflames vain ambitions and unjustified demands, and can encourage the emergence of informal groups with a treasonable tendency. Just as Ike had fought the Soviets of the 1950s with Louis Armstrong, Reagan and Bush ironically benefited from the influences of Madonna and Kiss. The American public, although pleased with the apparent end of the Cold War, remained skeptical and puzzled, unsure if the new system in Russia could last. Over two decades after the fall of communism, there has not yet been a single national celebration over success, nor a monument to the victory. Communism went out with a whimper, not a bang, hobbling the victory dance. Even before the Cold War embers had stopped smoking, Bush and the Democrats in Congress started spending the peace dividend they anticipated would result from the reduction of military forces. The demobilization that ensued, although smaller in scale than the reduction in force associated with any previous war, nevertheless produced economic and social turmoil. In a period of only a few years, aerospace and shipbuilding giants were nearly out of business. Thousands of engineers, especially in California, received pink slips. Companies scrambled to get out of defense contracting. Soldiers, airmen, and sailors were laid off as Bush foresaw a New World Order arising out of the ashes of communism's defeat. His unfortunate phrase, ironically uttered on September 11, 1990, just 11 years to the day before the attacks on the World Trade Center, set off the paranoid at both political extremes, who for years had prophesied that a secret international United Nations-directed body would dominate the world's affairs. Right-wing conspiracy theorists fretted about Bush's involvement in the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, whereas left-wing paranoids saw the New World Order as the final triumph of a greedy oil cartel. Bush lacked the political imagination for such global nonsense. What the verbally challenged president meant was that the world agreed communism was doomed and that the developed nations, including Russia, had to think in terms of cooperation instead of conflict. To that end, he sought to bring many former Eastern Bloc countries into NATO. And in 1991, Congress provided $400 million to help Ukraine and other fragments of the Soviet Empire dismantle their nuclear weapons. Saddam Hussein, megalomaniac. Military leaders, having learned their lessons in Vietnam, had already sensed that the next war would not resemble the massive armored frontal battle in European forests or a Southeast Asian jungle planned for by strategists of the Cold War. In all likelihood, new conflicts would involve a confrontation with a third world power. The generals correctly anticipated the style of the threat, but they failed to anticipate the setting. Communism had barely begun its collapse when Iraqi tanks rolled into neighboring Kuwait on August 2, 1990, claiming that Kuwait was rightfully part of Iraq and illegally separated by international fiat. Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein threatened all of the Persian Gulf with his large, well-trained army. Hussein, who wore an army uniform, held the title of president, but he stood in a long line of third-world dictators like Idi Amin and Muammar al-Qaddafi. Despite repeated warnings from American and Kuwaiti oil producers who had witnessed the military buildup and from the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, the Bush administration, preoccupied with Russia, was unprepared for the Iraqi invasion. By invading another Arab state, Hussein had the potential to capture and control large parts of oil production in the Middle East, posing a clear risk to American national security. Hussein had the largest and best-equipped army and air force, aside from Israel's, in the Middle East. Bush saw the peril of Hussein's control of the lion's share of Mideast oil. If Hussein succeeded in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia would be next. Uncharacteristically, Bush acted swiftly. Despite stiff resistance from Democrats in Congress, Bush mobilized an international response in the diplomatic arena. The United Nations imposed economic sanctions and prepared for military actions. He allowed a reasonable time for the economic pressure to work, at the same time instituting a buildup of troops in Saudi Arabia. Persuading the Saudis to permit large contingents of foreign, largely Christian and Jewish troops in their nation was a foreign relations coup for the American president. Under Operation Desert Shield, the United States sent 230 troops to ensure that the Iraqis did not invade Saudi Arabia, a force General Norman Schwarzkopf referred to as a tripwire. Democrats opposed plans to liberate Kuwait, raising the specter of another Vietnam. Senator Ted Kennedy warned of 80,000 body bags returning U.S. dead from the Persian Gulf if a war broke out, a number greater than the entire toll of dead in the 10-year Vietnam conflict. Some isolationist conservatives, such as Nixon and Reagan speechwriter and presidential candidate Patrick Buchanan, also bitterly condemned Bush's actions as unchecked internationalism. a small anti-war movement organized, brandishing signs saying, "No blood for oil" and "Bury your car." The administration, however, had no intention of being sucked into another protracted conflict, and in fact applied the lessons of Vietnam. Moreover, Bush followed Reagan's rules for engagement as he and his strategic leadership ensured from the outset that three critical differences would separate the war against Iraq from the failed Vietnam experience. First, Bush mobilized an international alliance such as the world had never seen. After securing authorization from the United Nations to repel Iraqi aggression, Bush persuaded Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and most of the NATO countries to send military forces totaling 200,000. More impressive, he gained assurances from Israel that if the Iraqis launched missile or air attacks on the Jewish state, Israel would refrain from counterattacks, which could have caused all the other Muslim members of the alliance to quit. Bush also obtained promises that Russia would not sell weapons to Iraq or offer other military assistance, marking the first time since the Cold War had begun that the two superpowers were aligned on the same side of a fight. Finally, although Japan's pacifist post-World War II constitution prohibited it from sending ground troops, the Japanese agreed to help fund the effort. Since Japan had to import 100% of its oil, the Persian Gulf conflict clearly affected Japan's national security. All in all, Bush had accomplished a stunning diplomatic coup by aligning virtually the entire world against Hussein, even to the point of neutralizing the Israeli-Arab antagonisms. Second, Bush's team was committed to not repeating the incrementalism that had characterized American involvement in Southeast Asia. Instead, after identifying a clear objective, the United States deployed overwhelming force and sufficient materiel to accomplish the task. Allied forces in the Gulf reached 430,000 after only a few months. Moreover, the Allies did not act until they had massed sufficient forces. Finally, Bush established a clear exit strategy: liberate Kuwait and significantly diminish Iraq's ability to threaten her neighbors again. Although critics complained about the word significantly, the objectives given to Allied Commander General Norman Schwarzkopf set specific reduction levels in tanks that would leave Iraq with no more than a foot soldier army. As General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had told his staff early on, "I won't be happy until I see those tanks destroyed. I want to destroy Iraq's army on the ground." Tank plinking. Air power as a decisive strategic factor in war had been hotly debated since World War II's Strategic Bombing Survey. After Vietnam, criticism of air effectiveness escalated to the point where the Air Force, Army, and Navy each undertook internal studies of the use of air power and engaged in planning for joint operations in which units of the different services would work together on the battlefield. Hussein's invasion of Kuwait offered a battlefield test of air power and its new doctrines. Here was a modernized enemy force, complete with top-level Soviet fighter planes, thick air defense around a major city, and troops who were dug in and, according to the prevailing views of strategic bombing in World War II, relatively safe from attacks from the air. Yet Allied airstrikes so effectively eliminated enemy opposition that the United States suffered fewer ground troops killed than in any major conflict in history, and the majority of those who perished were killed in either incidents of friendly fire or from a single long-range Scud missile attack on a barracks. Actual combat losses to the Iraqis were minuscule, 148 killed in the actual course of fighting. Using anti-radar missiles, the coalition forces, in a matter of hours, eradicated all of Iraq's ability to see Allied aircraft. Without enemy radar to contend with, coalition aircraft losses dropped to one aircraft per 1,800 sorties, a rate 14 times lower than during Vietnam's Linebacker II. Even hunkered-down, dug-in Iraqi armor was helpless against the air campaign. One crew of an F-111 bomber summed matters up in a nutshell. If armies dig in, they die. If they come out of their holes, they die sooner. Another likened the Iraqi army to a tethered goat. Using advanced radar, virtually every vehicle that moved could be identified and tracked. Over the course of the war to February 14, 1991, the radar-supported bombers decimated the Iraqis, plinking 1,300 out of 6,100 tanks, and even increasing that rate, taking out 500 per day at the peak of operations. Schwarzkopf's daring February 23rd offensive, which he called the Hail Mary, called for a feint into Kuwait, where the Iraqi defenses were thickest, followed by a massive and unprecedented shift of tanks, troops, helicopters, and, most important, fuel and supply vehicles far to the Iraqi flank in the desert. The war was over before it began. The Iraqis lost 76% of their tanks, 55% of their armored personnel carriers, and 90% of their dreaded artillery in approximately 100 hours. Iraqi soldiers, starving and mercilessly pounded by airstrikes, surrendered to CNN newsmen armed only with microphones and deserted at rates of 25 to 30%. Sensing they would be slaughtered if they remained anywhere near their vehicles, Iraqi drivers and gunners abandoned thousands of trucks, tanks, APCs, and scout cars on the famous Highway of Death leading out of Kuwait City. Estimates of Iraqi troop losses, although not entirely reliable, put the enemy death toll at 100,000 and the wounded at an equal number. Air power had proved so thoroughly destructive that the army only had to fire 2% of the 220,000 rounds of ammunition it had ordered for the theater. The Allied effort was a classic example of what Victor Davis Hanson called the Western way of war, all part of a cultural tradition to end hostilities quickly, decisively, and utterly. Just 5 days later, Hussein agreed to Allied terms. Unfortunately, at no time did the United Nations resolution or American objectives include taking Baghdad or overthrowing Hussein, leaving him as a malignancy in the region for another decade. Coalition partners, especially Islamic states like Egypt, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, feared that a fundamentalist Shiite regime might arise out of a Husseinless Iraq, while in America, Democrats continued to warn of a Vietnam-type quagmire. And Bush well remembered his predecessor's experience in Lebanon. In short, from the perspective of 1992, there were compelling reasons to quit. These were reasons that, even with the hindsight of the later attacks of 2001, one must conclude seemed sound at the time. A kinder, gentler America. Successful prosecution of the Gulf War propelled Bush to unparalleled levels of popular support, but only briefly. The public quickly forgot his overseas accomplishments when a brief recession ended the decade-long Reagan boom. In 1991 and much of 1992, the economy slowed. Historically, it was a mild recession, but the media and the Democratic contenders for president in 1992 made it out to be the worst economy in the last 50 years, a phrase Bill Clinton used repeatedly in his campaign. Bush had himself to blame. From the moment he took office, he believed the media gloomsters who warned that the federal budget deficits had reached intolerable levels. When considered in real, constant dollars, the deficits were slightly higher than in past decades, but hardly dangerous. Quite the contrary, the nation's GNP had grown faster than the deficits, reducing the real level of deficits to GNP throughout the Reagan-Bush years. But Bush had surrounded himself with Keynesian advisors who saw tax increases as the only solution to rising deficits. What followed was one of the most incredible political meltdowns in history, especially considering that Bush came out of the war with an 89% favorability rating in the polls. In 1990, pressure built on Bush to compromise with Democrats in Congress to raise taxes, ostensibly to reduce the deficit. Yet Democratic Congresses for 30 years had been comfortable with constant deficits, most of them proportionally higher than those existing in 1990. Only when it became a political weapon did they suddenly exhibit concern about the nation's finances, and then only in terms of raising taxes, not in terms of cutting massive federal expenditures. Bush agreed to cut spending in return for $133 billion in new taxes, the largest tax increase in the nation's history. The agreement slammed the top rate back up to 31% from 27%, imposed so-called sin taxes on tobacco and alcohol, which penalized the poor, and eliminated exemptions. Most important, it put Bush in the position of reneging on his "Read My Lips, No New Taxes" convention pledge. Bush sorely underestimated the public resentment of a bald-faced lie, especially the reaction of conservatives. Worse, he overestimated the veracity of the Democrats in Congress, where no substantive spending cuts took place. In the hinterlands, however, the Republican base was outraged, especially since Bush had marketed himself in 1988 as Reagan's successor specifically on supply-side principles. "Read my lips, I lied," blared the New York Post's front page. Many abandoned the GOP in disgust. Bush had put himself in a hole. Having sided with the Democrats and their tax increases, Bush could not tout tax cuts as a means to end the economy's slide. In addition, he seemed out of touch with the lives of ordinary Americans and unwilling to embrace Reagan's legacy. Whereas Reagan had come into office eager to abolish the Department of Energy and the Department of Education, and had failed to do so, Bush had no such prejudices against big government. His campaign theme of "a kinder, gentler America" seemed to agree with Democratic criticisms that Reagan's America had been mean and harsh. Bush celebrated a 1,000 points of light, a phrase that referred to the good deeds of millions of individual Americans who could privately shoulder some responsibilities carried by Uncle Sam. But he lacked a clear vision and obviously did not have Reagan's communication skills to enable him to go over the heads of Washington, New York media elites straight to American citizens. Even when Bush took positions that were far to the left of his conservative base, such as pushing through the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, and stricter environmental laws, he won no praise from the media, but instead was criticized for not doing enough. When Thurgood Marshall, the only African-American on the U.S. Supreme Court, retired, Bush nominated Clarence Thomas, a black conservative federal judge with an impeccable record. Instead of praising Bush's racial sensitivity, Thomas was viciously attacked at the Senate hearings when a University of Oklahoma law professor, Anita Hill, claimed Thomas had sexually harassed her. After a high-profile Senate hearing, Thomas was confirmed and became an outstanding and consistent justice. Thomas was representative of a new class of African Americans who had become successful and prosperous with minimal, if any, aid from government. Thomas once said, "I was opposed to welfare because I had seen its destructive effects up close in Savannah. My own sister was a victim of the system, which had created a sense of entitlement that had trapped her and her children." Thomas's views represented a significant threat to the civil rights establishment, whose central objective remained lobbying for government action on behalf of those it claimed to represent. Men and women like John Johnson, Michael Jordan, Herman Cain, and Oprah Winfrey, some of whom remained steadfast liberals and supporters of federal intervention, illustrated by their success within the market system that political favors played almost no part in economic achievement for blacks. At the same time, a new class of conservative black intellectuals arose. Thomas himself and men like Shelby Steele, Walter Williams, Glenn Lurie, and Thomas Sowell, that was at odds with the entrenched civil rights leadership, yet were deliberately ignored and trivialized by the media. Episodes of racial injustice, no matter how unusual or atypical, turned into opportunities to once again mobilize black political support around civil rights themes. To no small degree, such incidents became opportunities for black leaders, that is, those who wished to remain relevant, such as Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, to agitate. One such event occurred in April 1992 when four white Los Angeles police officers attempted to stop a black motorist who had run from them at speeds of more than 100 miles per hour. The driver, Rodney King, repeatedly resisted the officers, and the police suspected he was high on a narcotic, possibly PCP, psychoactive drug phencyclidine, which diminishes pain receptors. When King did not respond to oral commands, the police beat him with their clubs and hit him with a taser stun gun. A witness taped the entire episode with a video camera, and King sued the Los Angeles Police Department for violations of his civil rights. Tried in the mostly white northern Los Angeles suburb of Simi Valley, the officers were acquitted by an all-white jury. When the verdict was announced, South Central Los Angeles broke out in Watts-like riots and looting, protesting the appearance that the white officers got off the hook. It took troops 3 days to restore order, by which time 54 people had died and thousands of buildings had been damaged or destroyed. The Bush Department of Justice quickly hauled the officers up on federal civil rights charges, and on April 17, 1992, two of them were found guilty of violating King's civil rights and sentenced to 30 months in prison. It would not be the first racially charged case in Los Angeles to make news during the decade. I didn't inhale. Bush's weakness on the economy opened the door for a serious challenge to the sitting president from the Democrats, but it was still one he should have weathered. Instead, Bush found himself besieged not by one, but by two political opponents. Americans had become frustrated with the national debt and the annual deficits, but were unwilling to elect individual legislators who would resist the siren song of spending. A dynamic developed in which, to get elected, politicians of both parties would tout their ability to bring in dollars locally while opposing national spending programs in other districts. Moreover, structural impediments to change had afflicted the House of Representatives, where, by law, spending bills originated. Having held the majority for almost 40 years, Democrat-dominated committees did not even tolerate debate or discussion about many legislative items. Democrats controlled the Rules Committee and simply prohibited extensive analysis of spending bills. Indeed, proposals to cut taxes, to restrain spending, and to force various caps onto the budgetary process never made it to the floor of the House for a vote. Democrat leaders killed the proposals in committee, quietly and away from public roll calls, where voters could see their resistance to fiscal sanity. More than ever, politicians had started to become permanent Washington fixtures. Far from the Jeffersonian ideal of citizen legislators, many of the people who ran the nation had never lived or worked outside of Washington. Most of the members of Congress were lawyers who had gone straight from law school to government work. Few had ever run a business or had to show a profit or meet a payroll. In contrast, as legislators, when government ran short of money, they either ran a deficit or hiked taxes. There was never any talk of actually cutting back or belt-tightening. Gradually, popular resentment built up against politics as usual. It took the right person to tap into this well of anti-Washington sentiment. In 1992, H. Ross Perot, a Texas billionaire, burst onto the political scene. He had founded Electronic Data Systems, EDS, in 1962, turning it into a cash machine. In 1979, he funded a successful effort to pluck several EDS employees out of revolutionary Iran, which author Ken Follett later turned into a best-selling novel, On the Wings of Eagles. After selling EDS to General Motors, he started Perot Systems. By the time he began to appear in public forums, Perot possessed a certain amount of credibility. He initially appealed to many as homey, sensible, and practical, but at the same time he turned off elites like those swarming around the Clinton staff. Clinton Communications Director George Stephanopoulos called Perot a weird little man who was a ventriloquist's dummy for voter anger, a comment that itself showed how detached insiders like Stephanopoulos were. Perot's business background attracted many who were outraged by out-of-control deficit spending, and his simple-sounding solutions on the surface had appeal. He played to his role as an outsider, claiming he owed nothing to either of the established parties. Denouncing campaign spending, Perot refused federal money and financed himself in 1992. He carefully avoided any abortion position that would have alienated the sea of moderates, and he stayed away from any specifics in his policy recommendations for as long as possible. Adept with charts and graphs, Perot was the master of the political infomercial, but he faltered badly when confronted by a forceful critic. Unlike Reagan, though, Perot presented simple-sounding solutions that were often contradictory and poorly grounded in political realities. After a brief infatuation with Perot, the media turned hostile in early summer, leading the Texan to withdraw from the race in July. The withdrawal, however, was another Perot ploy to avoid close inspection. He re-entered the race in October, having avoided serious media scrutiny during the summer. He hoped to gain a plurality of the vote in enough states to snatch the presidency from Bush or Clinton. And his criticisms tended to disproportionately land on Bush rather than Clinton. In the wake of the Dukakis debacle, Democrats had decided they needed to move to the center. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton saw an opportunity to latch onto that sentiment, and he therefore supported several moderate positions, especially free trade through the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and welfare reform rather than welfare expansion. Clinton touted law and order issues and railed against deficits. Above all, he sought to repackage old, dilapidated liberal ideas with new language, calling government spending investment and referring to taxes as contributions. Awash in money and wielding a series of policy proposals designed to win back the middle class, Clinton should have been a formidable candidate. As it was, he stumbled. For one thing, he had dodged the draft during the Vietnam War. Reporters who had known the story all along and had failed to address it finally began to home in on his flight to England as a Rhodes Scholar, where he participated in anti-war protests, and on his manipulation of his college ROTC classification. There were equally damaging allegations of marital infidelity. Jennifer Flowers, a former lover, produced a tape-recorded conversation of Clinton telling her to lie about their relationship. Once again, the press had known about that relationship and effectively buried it until it could no longer be contained. Appearing with his wife Hillary on a 60 Minutes television interview, Clinton evaded the Flowers allegations but admitted there had been pain in their marriage, and the pair continued on as the happy and ever-politic couple. As the first major candidate from the boomer generation, "I never quite escaped Elvis," Clinton said of himself in his autobiography. Clinton portrayed himself as young and hip, appearing on a nighttime television show in sunglasses to play the saxophone with the band and answering questions about the type of underwear he wore on MTV. He admitted to smoking marijuana, but he didn't inhale. His brother Roger had been jailed for possession of cocaine. When it came to women, Clinton had used state troopers in Arkansas to introduce him to various girls and then employed the bodyguards to transport the females to and from their assignations. Most of his former sex partners remained silent. The few who did speak up came under withering fire from Clinton allies, who vilified them as nuts and sluts. A female Clinton staffer was hired to specifically deal with bimbo eruptions, claims by other women that they had had affairs with the candidate. Still, Clinton was the outsider who railed against the worst economy in the last 50 years and had great personal appeal. On Election Day, Clinton effectively secured 43% of the vote. Bush netted only 37%, and the spoiler, Perot, siphoned off 19%. Perot's total was significant, though less than the amount won by Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, when he had essentially denied the presidency to William Howard Taft. It would be inaccurate, however, to claim that Perot stole the election from Bush. Exit polls show that he took votes equally from both established candidates. Perot did damage Bush, however, by muddying the waters on Clinton's character and by portraying both parties as equally guilty of deficits, insulating Clinton from tax and spend criticisms, and naturally hurting the incumbent. Given Clinton's anemic popular vote, historians who for the most part are liberals have distorted the 1992 election to portray it as a victory for liberalism. Emphasizing the turnout, it was claimed the election reversed 32 years of steady decline in participation. Yet the additional turnout was not for liberalism or Clinton, but for Perot, and constituted a protest vote of disgust against both major parties. The election proved little. Bush had run away from his conservative base and alienated the low-tax crowd, while Clinton, portraying himself as a new Democrat or moderate, had adopted many of the Republican positions. Perot had offered no specifics whatsoever. Yet Clinton no sooner took office than he made a hard left turn. The Clinton Presidency. Understanding the Clinton presidency requires an appreciation for the symbiotic relationship between Bill Clinton and his ambitious wife, Hillary. Mrs. Clinton, a Yale Law School grad and staffer in the Nixon impeachment, had harbored political ambitions for herself since her undergraduate days at Wellesley. Her personal demeanor, however, was abrasive and irritating and doused any hopes she had of winning a political